or a slightly modified title, being calcimetry breaking and the spectrum of the QTD Dirac operator at non-zero baryon chemical potential. This is work I've been doing while being at Nordita, together with these distinguished gentlemen, Jacques, Gernot, and James. As was already uncovered, is that, well, this, of course, should remind us of the Banks-Cash relation and the central question that I want to address is what happens to the Banks-Cash relation as we turn on the baryon chemical potential. Well, why do you want to ask such question? Well, first of all, it's a non-trivial question because of the sign problem. The sign problem will allow for non-trivial solutions to this problem. And the central motivation is really to try to improve our analytic understanding of calcimetry breaking at non-zero baryon chemical potential. And I think it should be obvious to everybody why that's interesting. Now, this is a question which potentially every one of us could have asked ourselves over the last 20 years. Personally, I think I asked myself this question the first time about 5 or 6 years ago. And I haven't been able to come up with a solution for a long while because I lacked some input. And that input, which has led us to understand something more about this, was the fact that we saw last year the exact spectrum of the QTD Dirac operator at non-zero baryon chemical potential. And if you have such an exact solution, well, then you can start asking, so how do we actually get calcimetry breaking for that density? Well, of course, I didn't solve the QTD Dirac operator spectrum for any chemical potential and any temperature, because then I would have solved QTD and we could all go to the beach or anything else we'd like. We solved it in what's known as the epsilon regime. And what comes out is, well, at first at least it was sort of puzzling, is that not only do you get complex eigenvalues of the QTD Dirac operator, the eigenvalue density becomes a complex function itself. So you have a complex density in the complex plane. Okay, so just because, at least, I just got in here, and it's Monday morning, I thought we should start out slow. Just reminding ourselves, how does thing go at mu equals to zero, and why is it not trivial just to say mu not equal to zero, and this is how it must go.
Before you begin, just the trivial question about your remark that it's non-trivial because of the sign problem, because that's a technical problem for the lattice formulation.
You'll see. I'm sure. So let's just start out by having a brief look at the Banks-Cash relation. How does it go at mu equals to zero, and why is it not trivial just to put mu not equal to zero? Well, at mu equals to zero, let's look at the eigenvalues of d slash psi and write them as c psi. So the eigenvalues are just called c. And the eigenvalues, well, if this is the complex c plane, we'll see an imaginary part of c. Then, because this is an anti-emission operator, the eigenvalues are purely imaginary. If there are two eigenvalues here, there are, of course, two eigenvalues down here, just by the anti-commutation relation of d and gamma 5. So this should be such that the eigenvalues come in pair like that. The Banks-Cash relation is the relation between psi bar psi of m and the chiral content and the eigenvalue density, in particular when we take m to 0. The definition of this object is, of course, it's just 1 over the volume times the expectation value of the inverse of the trace of the inverse operator. If we write this trace here as a sum over eigenvalues and then convert the sum into an integral over the eigenvalues, then we get 1 over volume times integral dy. Let me call the imaginary part of c y and the real part of c for x. Then we get an integral from minus infinity to infinity over y. And we just get rho of y over c plus m. Now I use the fact that the eigenvalues come in pairs to write this as y squared plus m squared. and you get an m in the numerator as well. Now let's take the limit as m goes to 0, and we will have the Banks-Cashew relation. This part here becomes a delta function, and that makes the integral trivial. So we just get that the Banks-Cashew relation, namely that phi by psi in the chiral limit, is given by pi over volume times rho at the origin. So that's the central relation, the Banks-Cashew relation. Okay. One thing which will be useful today is to try and think of the relation between the chiral condensate and the eigenvalues here in a sort of electrostatic analogy. So if we plot as a function of mass, what is the chiral condensate as a function of mass, this quantity here? Then if we had electric charges sitting at the positions of the eigenvalues, then the chiral condensate as a function of m would be the electric field in the position out here on the real axis at position c equals to m. And it would, of course, point away. And as we change to the other side, it would point the other direction. And in fact, it looks something like this. It's constant here, drops down here, and it goes the other way. Well, it should have been a constant as well. Now, this is, of course, at small temperatures and at small quark masses. And what we want to know is what happens to this as we turn on the chemical potential. And in order to address that at all, of course, we should define what is the density at non-zero chemical potential. And the definition we want is a definition that allows us to take this sum here over eigenvalues and turn it into an integral over eigenvalues. So what we need is just delta functions sitting at the positions of the eigenvalues. And these now become delta functions sitting in the complex plane because we include the chemical potential term in the eigenvalue equation. We have an anti-Hermitian operator and a Hermitian operator and get complex eigenvalues. Okay, so that's the central idea. Just get a sum over delta functions. And we take the expectation value of that. And that is the full-blown expectation value in QCD with a sign problem and everything. Okay, so there's this oscillating determinant sitting down here, which weighs our operator. The operator here is a nice operator. It's real and it's positive. But now we weigh it with this oscillating measure, and that tells us that we cannot really expect this density to be real and positive. And in fact, as I already said, the density here will be a complex density. Okay, let's take one more step back before we go to the full case. Let's have a look at what happens in the quench case, because that will tell us something about what will happen in general. So let's look at mu not equal to 0, but in f equals to 0. In that case, let's again have a look at the eigenvalue distribution. That's something Dominique worked out a while back, and which is also known from lattice simulations, of course. The eigenvalues, well, the eigenvalues move into the complex plane. They still come in pairs, plus and minus c. And we can, of course, still write the eigenvalue density, or the chiral condensate here, psi by psi, of m. We can, of course, because of our definition of the density, we can still write it as an integral over the eigenvalue density, dc rho of c m over m squared minus c squared plus m squared. But now, this part here, because this is now a complex number, is no longer gives us a delta function as you take the mass to 0. It just doesn't. In fact, in the quench case, it's not so difficult to figure out what goes on. Because at small chemical potentials, and if you look close to the origin, I should have corrected that a little bit. Make that a little better. What happens is that the density of the eigenvalues is more or less constant. I don't seem to get this symmetric. Here we go. The density of eigenvalues in here is is different from zero, and it's a constant, and the density out here becomes zero. Now, if you have a distribution of eigenvalues like this, just using this electrostatic picture, it's very easy to see what the Carl condensate is as a function of mass. Well, if you're sitting with a mass which is way outside this distribution, it just looks like all the eigenvalues are sitting on a strip. So if you're sitting outside the distribution, you just get what you got before. This was as a function of mass. You just get an electric field that points in this direction. If you were sitting over here, of course, you would get an electric field which pointed in the other direction. And as you move inside the charge distribution, or the distribution of the eigenvalues, the electric field decreases until it reaches zero, as you're sitting here. That goes through the origin linearly.
So how wide is the distribution?
That's actually a good point. You can actually physically understand how wide the distribution is, because this point here is related to this fake phase transition, which is in quench QCD, which happens when the pion mass m pi over 2 is equal to mu. In that case, the quenched simulation as such here goes from the normal phase. Normal phase meaning pi by pi is non-zero and everything, into a dipole phase. Into a dipole phase. So the width of this distribution is m pi over 2 equals to mu. This is the quark mass, so you have to convert. So one thing we should notice in particular is that if you do a quench simulation and you take psi by psi of m, well, that actually goes to zero as m goes to zero for mu not equal to zero. That does not mean the Carl symmetry is not broken. It's just broken by this dipole condensate instead of the Carl condensate. Now, the object today is to see if we took an f different from zero, the eigenvalues, well, we still expect them to spread out into the complex plane, but how can we avoid getting this picture with a dipole condensate and instead get this picture where we just have a discontinuity of the Carl condensate at m equals to zero? And the solution is the following. The solution is this. Now, this plot here is a plot of the eigenvalue density in the complex plane, just like I plotted over there. It's a top view. It only shows the right-hand side. And it shows the eigenvalue density for one flavor in this epsilon regime, which I'll come back to. What you see here is that one part of the region here looks like the quench. There's sort of a constant part here, which drops down to zero as you go, as the real part of C becomes sufficiently big. And then there's a part here, which is sort of inside an ellipse, which is rapidly oscillating like this. And I cut off the top here so that we could see the drop off here. The top here is about 6 or 7 orders of magnitude higher than the plateau here. Okay, I'll come back to this plot all the time. I should show you where I got this plot from.
This is a plot of the eigenvalue density.
This is a plot of the real part of the eigenvalue density. The imaginary part is zero in this region here, and only inside this ellipse is it non-zero, and it looks more or less like this. It oscillates as well. This part is symmetric. The real part is symmetric around this axis. The imaginary part is anti-symmetric. Okay. The solution to this first came from a random matrix model, which was studied by James and published last year. And what I shall tell you next is how to get this from Carl perturbation theory, why we should trust this, why this is really what goes on in QCD. And that was published in this paper last year. Okay, I'll come back to this and tell you where it's valid and everything in a moment. So I decided to take the rest of the talk into two parts. First, how to get this unquenched eigenvalue density, why should we trust it, why does that have anything to do with QCD? And then second, how to go from this plot you just saw to get a Kalle condensate that just has a nice discontinuity at m equals to 0 and nothing else. So this is part one, how to get the unquenched eigenvalue density. Well, let's first remind us of the definition in this red box here. The definition is just the sum over delta functions. So if you're doing theory, if you're just sitting with pen and paper, how do you get these delta functions inserted into a theory? And there's a nice trick for that, which we made use of. You can write the delta functions using the replica method. What is the replica method? The replica method is that you insert some source, and then you take it out after making nice differentiations. And the source in the replica method is replicated numbers of fermions. So you just put in additional fermions, you differentiate with respect to their mass, and then you take them out again. So that's a mathematical way of writing the delta function. So you want to write the delta function. What you do is you write a generating functional for the eigenvalue density. It's the same as the QCD generating functional. It just has this additional index, which is the replica index, telling you how many extra fermions did I put into the system. The fermions comes as complex conjugate. They both have, one of them has a mass C, and the other one has mass C star. You put them into the theory. You calculate these objects. You take the free energy of the generating functional. You differentiate with respect to the mass and the complex conjugate mass, you divide by 1 over the number of these guys, and then you take the limit n to 0. If you do this mathematically, just on pen and paper, you get the delta functions back. So that's just the rewriting of this delta function here. The rewriting was invented by Gierko, I believe, in 1990. It was used in other quenched ensembles to study the quenched theories. So where this determinant's not sitting there, for instance, by Misha and also in the solid state community. And what I'm going to tell you is, based on this paper, how to do an unquenched, that this also can be used unquenched. Now, instead of telling you all the mathematical details, I thought I should tell you some of the physics that you can understand from this principle here. If we notice that the eigenvalues here appears as masses over here, so they appear as a mass over here. This means that if we choose to look at very small eigenvalues, that means that these masses are very small. Okay, let me say that again. Because that's really the central observation. If you look at eigenvalues, well, they appear as the masses of the conjugate fermions you put in, these replica fermions. So this means that if I choose, and that's my choice, I choose to look at very small eigenvalues, well, that means that these generating functionals have very light quarks in them. And these are not the physical quarks. These are just these additional quarks I put in. So I can choose their masses as I like. That depends on what eigenvalues I want to look at. So if I look at very small eigenvalues, I have very light quarks, and that makes Kalle perturbation theory work very well. So all I need to do...
Is there some constraint so that the theory stays asymptotically free?
I don't think that's a problem, really. I haven't thought about it, but I don't think...
Because if you put too many of them in...
Oh, yeah, that's certainly true. You don't want to get in the conformal window. Now, but you see, this is sort of a mathematical trick. What you do is you assume that Kalle symmetry is broken for any number of these NF, and then you take these additional flavors, and then you just take the additional flavors to 0. So you want to stay, you don't want to generate phase transitions, because that would obviously ruin the analytic continuation in the number of flavors. You just want to stay in the same phase.
Do you change the beta function when you change the number of fermions?
But I don't want to get in the conformal phase.
I'm not saying about conformal phase. I'm saying still you are in the normal phase. But do you change the beta function?
I guess the beta function follows, yes. Yes.
Yes.
What you should think is that I'm working at a number of flavors which is the additional number of flavors is almost zero. I'm working in the vicinity of zero, really. I don't really want to do it for 500 and then continue downwards. I just want to work in the vicinity of zero, because that's what the mathematics requires. I just need to put them in a little bit and then take them out again. And for any number of these flavors, what I'll do is I just assume that there's spontaneous breaking of Coase symmetry, and that will give me a low-energy effective Lagrangian, which is uniquely determined by the symmetries. And usually this is the Coase Lagrangian. What I'll get is not the Coase Lagrangian. That's because of this little parenthesis here that we should always remember, is that we don't get a unique theory. We get a unique bunch of terms. And which of these terms are more dominant depend on what counting scheme we take. And what counting scheme we take depends on what the quark masses are. And I just told you that I could choose these eigenvalues as I liked. That meant I could choose the quark masses that I liked. And I'll choose the quark masses to be very small, these additional quark masses. I'll choose very small eigenvalues.
Do you have all these problems related to the CP violation, Dachshund phenomena, and stuff like that? Because typically when you're close to zero, you have degeneracy, you do have all these problems immediately.
I've never thought about it. I've never bumped into those problems, I must say.
But Kim, there is a very important assumption you're making here, which
yeah.
is that you can describe the low energy, the low-lying eigenvalues by a random matrix, which is making an assumption about a random matrix description, which is making an assumption about the dynamics. Then you say the dynamics I want to be such that it breaks Coase symmetry. You know what the effective action is, so you can connect the microscopic quantities of the density of these eigenvalues to the macroscopic quantities. Of, say, the Coase condensate. Isn't that what is essential? And under that assumption, this works for any number of flavors, because that's what you build in. You say, I can take any
that's true.
Down the effective model for that. There's no running of the coupling, no dynamics of the gauge, back coupling of the gauge field, except that you assume you can describe it by a random matrix model, right?
Well,
I thought you were deriving this from
I never,
you need to have the right symmetry breaking.
Yeah, so
and
you assume
that you don't need the random matrix.
You need to assume that you have an effective Coase theory, but.
Yeah, and the effective Coase.
But that works for any NF.
Yeah.
So you don't need random matrix. Not for you to assume that the symmetry breaking is such as this, and then you can build up the effective theory the way you want. You don't need to say that there's a non-reverse behind it.
The only thing I'll need is it's in fact what's right here. So let's just do that. What I'll do is I'll assume that the Coase condensate that the quark mass is small. These are in fact the pion mass of these additional quarks I'd introduced. I'll assume that that is of the order of the chemical potential, and that these two quantities are of the order of the inverse volume.
Do you assume that actually your ground state is unique? Because CP violation, spontaneous CP violation, actually, the way how it happens, you have a couple of...
It does do that. You could introduce a theta angle. And
No, I'm not talking about that. Even that equals pi, you have a couple of states.
Yes.
And you have CP violation without...
He's assuming everything is normal.
Yeah. I'm assuming...
But you definitely know that if you introduce massless quarks, which I did generate, you do have Dachshund phenomenon immediately. And you do have.
We in fact worked this out. Dachshund phenomena does occur in this limit as well, in this epsilon regime. It does occur as a function of the quark mass, but one has to take the quark masses in a special scaling regime. I can tell you about that separately later.
You try to avoid it by taking the limit in a special way.
No, I don't have to avoid it. It really happens as a function of the theta angle. I think it's a separate issue. So let's just continue along this line. And we can talk about it. I mean, we wrote a paper about that a while back. What I wanted to do was I wanted to tell you where is the epsilon regime sitting in the normal mu b g plane, so that I'm not cheating anybody by telling you this is more general than it is. Suppose this is our usual scheme, and there's the usual sort of order of magnitude telling us there should be some phase transition sitting out somewhere up here. what I'm doing is I'm not sitting in this plane at all. I'm doing what we are doing in a Lattice simulation or whatever. I'm sitting at a finite volume, which is not taken to infinity yet. I can take it to infinity, but that means that I should take mu to 0 and then pi to 0. So in this plane, for instance, I should stay on a constant line of mu times volume. That's why mu times what square root of volume. So that's why I'm sitting sort of in a wedge here. And I have to sit at small temperatures, so I have to sit sort of somewhere. Let's see if I can draw something like this. I have to sit somewhere inside this wedge here in the mu t plane. And of course, this is a very interesting question. How do you get from a finite volume simulation out here onto this plane? That's really what we want to know. Okay? And that's why this in the epsilon regime, we actually know how to do that. And that's what we will see here. Okay, given all the standard assumption of the spontaneous breaking of Carle symmetry, what pattern it takes, we get the Carle Lagrangian. This does not look quite much like the Carle Lagrangian. In fact, if you drop this term, it looks more like the one-link integral. And the reason is that when you go to this epsilon regime, Leutwiller and collaborators figured out that the zero mode of the pion field actually dominates the measure. And the non-zero modes factorize. They just give an overall normalization constant. I drop that constant. And what I get here is not a path integral. It's just a matrix integral over the zero mode of the pion field. So this is just a matrix integral over the coset of spontaneous breaking of Carle symmetry. And what I have here is the mass term. I don't get any derivative terms of the field. I just have the quadratic mass term, the mass term, and then I have a term which is quadratic in the chemical potential. The M which appears here is the quark mass matrix, and in the same way, this is the baryon charge matrix. So usually in Carle perturbation theory, the baryon charge matrix would be equal to proportional to unity, because all the quarks have the same charge, but I'm looking at these generating functionals which has these extra quarks in them. Some of them are quarks, and some of them are conjugate quarks. And the conjugate quarks have baryon charge opposite of the quarks. So for instance, if NF was equal to 2 and N was equal to 1, my baryon charge matrix would be 1, 1, 1, minus 1. Okay? And what this is telling me, this coupling of the chemical potential to these these pion fields, is simply that some of these pions here have baryon charge different from zero. Okay? And that's the pions made up of one of these additional conjugate quarks and an ordinary quark. So those are the guys that introduces the coupling to the chemical potential. And this coupling is there for any n, a small n not equal to zero. Okay, one can write this up. This is the constant terms you get from Carle perturbation theory, which is described in these two papers and others. The static integral was first written up by Dominique and Jacques a while back. Writing it up is one thing. solving the bloody thing is different. It's not as terrible as it could be. This is a nice integral. It's a compact integral, and one can actually do it. If nf was equal to 0, then for any value of this n here, we managed to solve it last year. And some of our good friends managed to extend that calculation to having also nf not equal to 0. So you calculate all these objects. So suppose you want to know this integral for any value of nf and any value of n, you just ask me. I know the reference, or you look it up in one of these two.
Can you take the real part of Z to be always smaller than the quark mass?
This is valid. The real part of Z, this is actually valid everywhere.
Because
this knows about the phase transition.
What I'm worried about is the following. If I have this baryon charge here, and I have basically a quark and a conjugate quark, the smallest the mass, the baryon that they make corresponds
yep.
as soon as mu is going to reach this mass of the light as Goldstone, I'm going to have a super free phase just to use.
Yeah, this general annihilating function will know about both phases. Yeah. Okay, so why did I bother to tell you about all these? Let me remind you, the idea was what's here, that once I know all these generating functionals, I take the log of them, I differentiate twice with respect to the masses, and then I pick out the term which is of order n by taking the limit n to 0 divided by 1 over n. Okay, that's something you can do. That's another 2 years project to take that limit, but you can do it. If you're interested, I have a special slide for that as well. It's related to the fact that this generating functional satisfied a recursion relation known as the totalizer's equation, and that way you can actually take the limit n to 0 in a nice way. Once you've done it, you get one of these nice pictures again. This is again the real part of the density, and I've shown now just the upper quadrant here, just this part here. The real part of the density is symmetric around this axis, and it's symmetric around that axis. The imaginary part, well, the imaginary part is just non-zero inside this ellipse. It's antisymmetric around this axis, and it's antisymmetric around that axis. Okay, again, this is what it looks like. And there's a couple of features I'd like to tell you. First of all, this oscillations again. The oscillations, well, I've chosen to scale the imaginary axis here with the volume. So this means that the period of these oscillations you see here is actually 1 over the volume. The amplitude inside this region grows with the volume, exponentially with the volume. So that's two features. That's one more feature I'd like to point out, is that as you take the eigenvalue density here, it changes signs right here. This is 100, and that's the quark mass that I took to be 100 in these rescaled units. And that's not too difficult to understand again. If you just look at the eigenvalue density, well, there's the fermion determinant sitting in the measure, and that actually changes signs right there when the eigenvalue passes by the mass. So that's why the eigenvalue density actually changes sign at that point. Okay, using these rather general features, that there's a region sitting here which oscillates with a period of 1 over volume and has an exponentially large behavior out here, exponentially large amplitude, that's actually enough to get a picture just like this. Okay, so that gives us to the second part. Namely, we want to take this object here, or rather, we want to take just the general features that it's oscillating with a period of 1 over volume. It has an amplitude that goes like exponentially in the volume, and that's actually sufficient to give us a picture just like that. So that tells us how to get the Kao condensate from the eigenvalue density. Okay, so let me get on with that. Well, by the very definition of our eigenvalue density, as I said before, we can take this, write it as a trace, and we can convert the trace into an integral. And what I'll conclude over the last, well, how much do I have? I have a good time. Yeah. That the oscillations we just saw in the eigenvalue density, which are due to the sign problem, this is really the manifestation of the sign problem in the eigenvalue density. Those are actually responsible for Kao symmetry breaking. So that will be the conclusion. And you can find detailed discussion here. Now, since there's a lot of things in this part, I thought I should show you that there's something amusing about it. If you write the real part of the eigenvalue density, well, we can take one of these plots here. Let me try and sketch what it looks like. There was a region in which there was a support, sort of the eigenvalue density. And then starting from the, so this is again real C and imaginary C. And out here, the rho is 0. Inside the support, starting from real C equals to the quark mass, there was sort of a region like this where the eigenvalue density was behaving wildly. It was had these oscillations. You can, of course, you can always do that. You could write the eigenvalue density as the eigenvalue density of an f equals to 0, and then you could add a correction to that. The eigenvalue density equal to 0, we already have that over on the right-hand side. That's just this constant part, which we also saw in the picture sitting in this region here. And then there's the correction part, which is this blob starting at m, which looks somewhat like this. Now, the reason why I bother to separate it into these two parts is because if you do the integral dy, rho of x and y, so this is nf, times m, so this is the integral we want to know. So the chiral condensate is the integral over y and over x of this. But it actually turns out that the integral over y is rather easy, and one can actually understand it analytically why the integral over y is very simple. It's not so that only after integrating over both x and y you get a simple picture. In fact, only after integrating over y you get a simple picture. Okay? That might be, at least that to me came as a slight surprise. So this is the quantity, and what I want to do is I want to plot this as a function of x. So what I want to do is I want to take some line somewhere, say here, and I want to integrate along this line given x. And the contribution from the quench part, well, we actually already have that on the blackboard. So this is this quantity where I took in here and replaced the quench part. We know that it's going to look like this once we integrate it over x as well. And so it's actually easy. The quark mass is sitting somewhere here. And of course, the quench part doesn't know about the quark mass. And the solution is simply, as long as you're sitting inside the pole, you just get a constant. And that goes on until you hit the quark mass, and then it goes to 0. Now, the area of this is the chiral condensate as a function of m. And we know that the area should go linearly to 0 with m. That is exactly what we had over here. So this is a solution. Now, the solution from this part, well, what I want to do is I want to integrate through this part. I want to put the correction part in here and just do this integral. And what I hope to convince you about is that that's actually a rather simple integral to do, and exactly because of these oscillations. I should get about the same height as over here. And it just gives a constant as long as you're inside the support of the eigenvalues. Otherwise, it gives 0. So we add these two, and that gives a very simple answer, like this. And what that shows you is that the area of this here, the mass is sitting somewhere here, the area of this is independent of where m was sitting. The area was the chiral condensate as a function of m. So it's independent of m as long as we are not at m equals to 0. And if you follow the dynamics, actually, there's also a sign change at m equals to 0. So that's what we want.
Can you give us some feeling why, when you integrate over the ellipse, that you get a constant that yields oscillation?
That's a perfect answer. Sorry, that's a perfect question, because that's exactly what I'm going to do for the next 5 minutes. Yep.
What the upper limit is there? I mean, when we knew what it was, but now you're not doing. I mean, why should there be some step on the right when you do it in full QCD? I mean, when we knew there was this fake stuff, but in full QCD, you shouldn't have the fake stuff.
This result.
Yeah, well, why the right hand chop? What happens there in full QCD?
In full QCD.
What's the physics of that?
The physics of that is most easily seen from these generating functionals. So the generating functionals for the eigenvalue density, if you, let's have a look. That's a good point, that's why. So I'll answer your question after I answer this question.
Sorry.
Okay. So we're looking at...
Well,
we're looking at generating functionals for the eigenvalue density, which are given by an integral dA. There's the usual determinant to the nf, and then there's a determinant absolute squared to the 2n, and then there's the standard action. Okay? These generating functions here have a phase transition when the mass hits this boundary here. So the behavior of the eigenvalue density is related to the phases of this theory rather than to the phases of QCD.
Okay, so it's some unphysical thing in some sense. Well, it's physical, but not in normal physics.
Yeah. Right, so it's like the Quint theory has some wacky behavior which is related to the phases of this theory.
It's even wackier theory, so it's also got something similar
to that.
Okay.
You see? Yeah, should we leave it at that? maybe one can stress it a little bit more. What Misha showed was that if we look at the generating functionals for the eigenvalue density, quench eigenvalue density, this has a fake phase transition. And that's the fake quench phase transition. If you look at this spectrum here and this result, you might think that there's another fake phase transition. There's one here and there should be one here. And in fact, there is in this game here. But once you add this guy up and that guy up, you get something that doesn't have a phase transition. Okay?
But finally, you're making a real prediction for QCD.
It gives you
of the imaginary part of you're looking for. You're saying that you don't have arbitrarily large imaginary eigenvalues of the Dirac operator for fixed mu.
Yes. That is correct.
That shouldn't be surprising or bizarre.
I don't know, when I see something that's oscillating with a period that goes as volume and, a period that goes as 1 over volume and an amplitude that goes exponentially in volume, I'm tempted to use the word bizarre, but...
but it's QCD.
It's QCD, yes.
So you're making a prediction in this epsilon version, right?
That is correct.
The behavior of the eigenvalues.
Yes.
That should be the real theory. But it's only in this epsilon regime that when you go outside of the ellipse, you get no eigenvalues anymore. So if you go outside of the epsilon regime...
I can't say anything about what goes on outside the epsilon regime because I only calculate inside the epsilon.
But
if you follow the argument of how to get something constant from this, which I'll present in the next 5 minutes, you'll see that that's very general, in fact. It's almost as general as the usual argument we did here in order to get that the eigenvalue density was equal to this, the standard Banks Cashel relation. So this suggests that if you go to higher chemical potentials, all you have to do is you might to make sure that you get this eigenvalue density, which above the quark mass has this oscillating behavior. That oscillating behavior is what allows you to recover this.
I'm trying to understand this answer you gave to Norman's question that for fixed mu there are not arbitrarily large eigenvalues. Is that a statement that...
You have absolutely large with real part, right? But with the imaginary part, but not real part.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's also
interesting. Yeah. Do you have any idea how the area of this ellipse depends on mu? Does it get larger as mu gets larger?
Yes, we have the analytic solution to it. Should I answer that now? No, I don't want to answer that now. I'll come back to that. Because I want to answer Pierre's question first. What we wanted to do is we wanted to take the correction term, and we wanted to do the integral with the pole through, as a function of y, through this oscillating region. And I want to give you just not the full explanation, but just the feeling of how can one get something simple from a function that has this behavior, which I've been showing you. So here's a function that has this behavior. It has an envelope here, and it has an oscillating term here. The envelope is such that if this thing, which is in the square bracket, is negative, then we are inside this ellipse, where the eigenvalue density blows up with exponential in the volume. Otherwise, it's small. Okay, and that's the structure of the correction term. So this function here, I know that analytically, and that's your question. What does that actually look like? And yes, it does grow with the volume. What happens is that the boundary of the eigenvalues moves out, and the ellipse starts still at the quark mass, and you just get a bigger ellipse every time. It also gets larger in the other direction. Okay? And then you have this oscillating term. Now, what we want to do is a one-dimensional integral. And one way to do one-dimensional integrals is by going into the complex plane of that one variable. So I do an integral of y, and I go into the complex y plane. And because what I'm integrating is not a holomorphic function, that's different from going into the complex eigenvalue plane. And the structure in the complex y plane is easy to follow. From y squared, you get a squared minus b squared. I call y equals a plus ib. And from this term here, and that's the important thing, you also get a contribution. So the oscillating term, because it's oscillating through the period of volume, you get a quantity which is of the same order as this term. And then you get some oscillating junk again. Now, I tried to make an illustration, which I didn't want to do on the blackboard here. So what we want to do is we want to take this part here, this integral here, with the pole sitting there, and we want to make an integral along this line through this oscillating region. Now, if there was only this exponential term, which did not have the oscillations, then going in the, so I transform this into the complex y plane. If there was not this oscillating term, I would just get, I'm here in the exponentially enhanced region. If I went in the negative b direction and the positive b direction, I would just get more amplitude. The amplitude would just be exponential all the time. But because I have this linear term, which came from the oscillating part, I can have a competition between the linear and the quadratic term. So the quadratic term will win eventually. It will be exponentially big, and it will be exponentially big over here also. But there will be a tiny region, if we are lucky, where the amplitude of the correction is still exponentially suppressed. So I can deform my contour into that region. And that means that what I get from the integral here, well, this is now an exponentially suppressed quantity in the volume. So I just get zero. But I should remember that I passed the pole, so I just pick up the contribution from the pole. OK. So we now understand, hopefully, that was the idea with this plot here, is that once we do an integral of this sort, all we do is we pick up the pole. And that, of course, depends on what this function in the exponent looked like. Let me get back to my slide. That, of course, depends on exactly what this function looked like. I know this in the epsilon regime. I know this function in the epsilon regime. That's what I calculated. And what happens is that exactly when we're integrating through this oscillating region, that is for the real part of the eigenvalue being between the quark mass and the boundary of this surface, I have this competition between the linear term, and the linear term actually wins. That I can go into this suppressed region. So this means that this integral for this values of x is just given by the pole term. So now all we have to convince ourselves about in order to get this thing back that I have back here. So all of this contribution here is given by the pole term.
Okay, but that is valid in the limit phi to infinity, and there are exponential corrections because of this contribution inside.
Exactly. So what I want to do is, in fact, I want to keep something like I want to keep something like m times volume times psi bar psi. I want to keep this much, much larger than 1. And that's exactly the right chiral limit to take. I want to take the volume to infinity first and then m to 0. So it's the right physical limit to go to. OK. So now we convinced ourselves that this plot just came from the pole. And now we just have to convince ourselves that the contribution from the pole is constant in this region. And that actually has a very simple explanation, which is completely general, and it's on this slide here. Well, the contribution from the pole is given by the residual of the function, and the correction factor at the pole is just a constant. It doesn't depend on x. Now, how can that be? Well, let's remind ourselves what the correction factor was. The correction factor was just the difference between the full eigenvalue density and the quenched density. Now, when I was discussing this plot here, what I was showing you and emphasizing was that the eigenvalue density changed sign exactly when the when c is equal to the eigenvalue. So this means, and this is the point where I want the pole, which means that this part here is zero, exactly at the pole. The quench eigenvalue density is a constant throughout the phase, and in particular, it's constant at the pole. It doesn't know about the pole. So this means that just because this thing vanishes at the pole and this thing is constant at the pole. Okay, so it's only because the eigenvalue density vanishes at the pole. So what I've used is I've used this oscillating behavior. The oscillation must go like with a period like volume and exponentially, a period like 1 over the volume, and must have an amplitude which is exponential in the volume. That's how the sign problem manifests itself. I used the fact that the eigenvalue density changes sign at the mass pole, and that was enough to get a new independent Carl condensate from a complex and oscillating mu-dependent density. Okay. Of course, I used this special solution in the epsilon regime to guide me to get this result. And of course, one can take the specific example I had there and look at all the values and see how nicely everything goes. But I believe this is more general. So just to conclude, we went from an oscillatory spectral density, and we got a very simple discontinuity of the Carl condensate, just at m equals to 0. Nothing happened as we hit the boundary of this of the eigenvalue density. One point which is worth pointing out is that the entire oscillating region contributes to the Carl condensate. It's not just some little region somewhere. It's the entire region of the complex part of this oscillating part. We found this using the exact eigenvalue density in this epsilon regime. And one thing which is worth pointing out is that the epsilon regime was actually ideal for this, because unless we scaled the eigenvalues by a factor of the volume, we would never have seen these oscillations. It was really important that we saw the oscillations on the factor of 1 over volume. OK, that's it. Not in the epsilon regime, because temperature has something in Carl perturbation theory to do with loops and things. And in the epsilon regime, we just have this constant. What usually happens in the epsilon regime is that the Carl condensate, the temperature just enters by a rescaling of the parameter, which we call the Carl condensate. So there's a parameter, Carl condensate, which is the external parameter. And what usually happens, that's why I allowed myself to go a little bit up this axis, is that what usually happens as we go up this axis at mu equals to 0, where we have tested all these results, is that you just have a rescaling of the Carl condensate. So you just get psi by psi of t.
This decomposition that you make between the density, the full density for a fixed number of flavor, as the density is zero,
yep,
flavor plus correction. But somehow we know that the zero, the limit of zero flavor is more. So only if you take the limit of the theory with NF flavors and NF conjugate flavors.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of concerned that you can decompose so easily the physical density for NF flavor as NF equals 0 plus corrections.
Yeah, you saw the correction was, of course, huge. I mean,
it seems something that's
not zero here. Yeah. I see that decomposition more as a mathematical way to illustrate. You have one function which we believe is the correct function. And you write it as something that has something to do with the quench. That's a very smooth function. It's a nice little function. And you just say, yeah, I don't share your concern, at least.
Can you remind me why this full row was zero at the pole? Sort of
because
that's very essential for your argument.
Right, and it's actually quite general, I think. Perhaps the most easy thing for me is to try and remove this part here. The argument I like is to try and write the density of eigenvalues, and let's put in the mass as well, in terms of it's the expectation value of delta functions. So if I could write the partition function in terms of eigenvalues, if I had some eigenvalue representation, all I should do is I should integrate over all the eigenvalues, ci equals 1 to however many there are. I'll get some complicated measure, of course, for this, some very strange Jacobian from going from QCD to eigenvalue representation. But what I know I'll also get is, of course, I'll have the delta functions there, c minus ci. But what I also know I'll get is I'll get a product over eigenvalues, ci minus m. Well, now I screwed up the sign somehow. Let me write it like this. Then at least it will work for my argument. It's because it's, let me write it like this. And then whatever measure I have out here, I neglect that. So when I do the delta function sitting at m, that is like asking one of these eigenvalues to be sitting at m.
Yeah, okay.
So the determinant.
That is zero. That's clear. But the only thing is that the way you got it, you had a determinant where the m was as the number of flavors. And you had to determine the other determinant that depended on the number of replicas. So I don't immediately see.
No, but that's not the definition of the eigenvalue density. Can I find that again? The eigenvalue density. That's just what I used.
Okay.
That's just what I used to calculate it. Yes.
So it's
just because the determinant changes sign,
yeah.
And I freeze one of these eigenvalue integrations by the delta function.
Okay.
So when I change that sign, I change this sign. Yeah. So it's, you know, this is a complicated integration, of course, and magic could happen to sort of cancel that. But it's, you know, we calculated it in the epsilon regime. We saw this was the case, and we thought it was very, at least one has to come up with something rather specific to cancel that sign change, which. No, that's not a pole sitting there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the pole coming from? The pole is something we put in by hand when we want to calculate this.
Yeah.
But that's only when we want to calculate this. Now we were just looking at the eigenvalue density itself. So.
Okay, wait, sorry. Any other questions?
So your spectral density is actually made of two blobs. It's symmetric with respect to the vertical axis.
That's true. So.
And the size of each of these blobs increases as it increases.
That's true.
So
let's have it here. This is now the full density. What it looks like is like this. It starts from m and it goes out to this point here, which in this limit is 2 mu squared f pi squared over psi bar psi at 0. So as you increase mu, this extends and the psi here also extends.
Is it plausible that a phase transition will occur when the topological features of this spectral density will change, like the two blobs will merge into one or in an annulus? Or?
Yeah, that's a good question. I cheated you a bit. Everything I've shown you so far is in the topological sector, mu equals to 0. In the fixed topological sector, so you
Q equals
Q? Okay, I usually call it nu.
Nu.
That's what I tried to say. Maybe I said something else. Yeah. Okay, whatever you call it. Nu equals to 0, that's what I usually call it. The eigenvalue density in the relevant limit, which is this limit where m times volume is big, doesn't depend on nu. So you could have done it for any topological sector. So I don't think that anything will happen in as a function, as you try to sum over all the topological sectors.
I'm talking about the topological features of the spectral density.
Oh.
Right now, it's two disconnected blobs, maybe they merge into one blob or into an annulus.
As a function of?
Mu. The chemical tension.
No, they always have to start at the quark mass. And what happens as the chemical potential grows is just
outside
a
the epsilon regime.
Outside the epsilon regime, you know, I have my hands in the air. I don't know. I think this was a sufficiently surprising result to me that I would, I mean, you can ask another question. What happens as you crank up the temperature? One way to restore Carl symmetry is that you still have lots of spectral density here, but just the features of the oscillating region just changes. It doesn't necessarily have to be that eigenvalues move away from the origin.
There's one thing, Philippe, I think, since he can't see the color flavor locking phase, because he threw out the Gates degrees of freedom are replaced by the pion degrees of freedom. So this only works in the phase where the pion effect of Lagrangian is what you have. So it's under this assumption that he is in this phase, is the effect of pion Lagrangian.
That's
so
certainly true.
He cannot see the phase.
That's certainly true.
Yeah, you can never go to bion masses chemical potential, right? You limit yourself as having extra tiny chemical potentials anyway.
Oh, yeah. That's certainly true. That's why I draw this wedge there. This is really where I'm sitting. This is, but what we might be able to learn is that there's a general mechanism with this oscillating density where you can get a picture of Carl symmetry breaking, even though the mass moves inside the support of the eigenvalues.
Any further questions? If not, let's thank Kim again.